Good evening. Welcome. It's my pleasure to again today introduce our speaker for the evening, Monsignor Charles Fahey. Monsignor Fahey has been with us for two other events today and is holding up fine. I just had dinner with him, and he still is able to take nourishment and talk. He does great. He's doing very well, and he is an activist in many ways for the third age, as he describes it, and spoke to us earlier today as a way of understanding the third age of human life, a new experience for us. His lecture this morning talked about the social construction of ages of life and described this third age, childhood, adulthood, and then this older adulthood. He is an activist in many ways, and a successful activist, because he's very much engaged in the conversation places in government and church and academics, in a variety of places, both nationally and internationally, to engage all of us in thinking freshly about this social transformation and change and the possibilities that lie in front of us, as well as the challenges and concerns. He is not only an activist, he's an ethicist. He's concerned about the moral qualifications and concerns for that, and he speaks all over the country and the world on a regular basis, and I think probably just is on the go all the time, not because of his own interest for his own aggrandizement, but so that the number of people who are aware of this issue and are engaged in this issue increases. And we're fortunate this evening to have him address us on the issue of aging and the social concerns and public policy concerns that are affiliated with that. It's my pleasure to introduce to you Charles Fahey. Welcome.
Well, once again, it's a pleasure for me to be able to be with you. And following the natural progression of the day, we've sort of tried to frame the general consideration, the demographic change, and to suggest a method of thinking about it. This afternoon, we spoke about the congregation and pastoral ministry. This evening, we want to talk a little bit about the issues of public policy that are generated by the demographic imperative. This afternoon, one of the things we talked about was death and dying, and I'm reminded of a story, if I may tell a story. We Irish are inclined to tell stories, you know. And it seems that Pat was dying, and Pat was in the hospital, and he said, "Oh, if I could go home and die in my own bed with Molly at my side, I would go to my maker happy." So the people in the hospital said, "Certainly make a home," and so on. So he went home. And he's in the bedroom, and he's in the bed, and you can barely tell whether he's dead or alive. And suddenly he comes to life and says, "Molly, Molly." And surely she thought this was the end. And she came rushing in and says, "Molly, is that corned beef and cabbage that I smell?" And she says, "Oh, yes, it is, my dear." He says, "Molly, if I could but have a morsel. I've had the last rites. I'm ready to go, and this would be my last wish. If I could have but a morsel." She said, "Oh, I'm sorry. We're saving it for the wake." I'd like to draw to your attention several paradoxes that we face as a nation, and increasingly we will face as a world. And one is the increase of the people in the population, our brothers and sisters who are dependent. Abortion notwithstanding, the number of dependent people of every age is growing at a rapid pace. Low birth weight babies who heretofore would not have survived. People who are traumatized through automobile accidents, gunshot, whatever the case may be. Persons who suffer heart attacks or other kinds of onsets of unexpected disease or illness and so on. And then, of course, those among us who are older, who will be able to avoid the ravages of various illnesses and so on, but bring with us a certain degree of chronic illness that may render us dependent from a physical point of view. So both in absolute and relative numbers, we have more and more people who, from an economic point of view, are non-producers. Now, we've always had non-producers who have been socially constructed as such, if I may borrow what was said, and that's children, for example. And we recognize that as a community, as a society, and indeed in public policy, that we ought to afford children a period to grow up, and that we tax ourselves substantially for school systems. We try to afford them one way or another enough economic security to have decency, although with various debates about welfare, we're not exactly sure how to do this. We not only involve ourselves as taxpayers, but we do as parents, as friends, as volunteers, and we have a whole variety of social structures that enable children to go through a period for their personal growth so they can be decent human beings, but also for the common good that they may be able to take their place in society as good parents, as good workers, as producers of goods and services, and so on. So we have those temporary dependencies. On the other end of the scale, we have socially constructed retirement. Now, when I say this, for long periods of time, there was no real retirement or pension programs. But at the time of Bismarck, there was a recognition with the Industrial Revolution that we simply did not need the number of people to produce the goods of society, and therefore there had to be a way from a social justice point of view to make sure people continued to have enough stuff for decency, oh yes, and to keep them quiet in terms of the social order, but also that there was a need to get them out of the workforce in a way in which they would positively want to leave while they still had some capacity and that they would be able to leave it. So retirement is socially constructed. We see it not necessarily tied into capacity at all, but rather that there are certain junctures, some quite artificial, 65 or whatever it is, others occasioned by mergers or whatever, where golden parachutes are given and people are encouraged, strong incentives, to leave the workforce. But from an economic point of view, that these folks, no matter how capable they may be, or even how much they have saved to some extent, they continue to be economically dependent upon current productivity. Virtually all pension programs are dependent upon current producers. Very few of them are funded anywhere near the needs that are there. In fact, some recent activities on the part of the accounting community required corporations to begin to account for their liability, both for health care and for pensions, in a different way so that it would be seen that this is a liability that they have to take out of their profits to be able to give to people. So the first phenomenon I note is that we have a growing number of dependent people. People are dependent physically. People are dependent psychologically. People are dependent economically. Now, in a relatively quiet way, there was a dramatic social policy change in the past few years that became articulated in public policy in the Americans with Disabilities Act, whereby we redefined, in a sense, disability and said disability, while there are personal characteristics, in some way it's society that's disabled. And therefore, society ought to change its ways to allow those with physical handicaps to participate in the workforce and then to be able to produce. And indeed, many of them are for their own personal psychological well-being, but also for the well-being of society as a whole, as they're able to use their creativity in a variety of ways. So this has occasioned a change in attitudes, but in physical structures and a variety of other things. Not, by the way, without their social costs to enable people, and someone someday will do an accounting of whether from a strictly economic point of view, the economic costs are a plus or a minus by all these arrangements. So the first phenomenon is just the growing number of dependent people in society. The second phenomenon is the increased production of the few. Now, historically, from our economic analysis point of view, you had capital, and you had raw materials, and you had labor. And in some way, the interaction of these things would produce goods and services that society needed. And in a simpler time, we, of course, had very heavy emphasis upon labor, because people had to dig the ditches and build the canals and the railroads and the steelworks and so on. But we have seen a gradual change where systems and machinery and computers and a whole variety of things have increased the capacity of individuals to be able to produce stuff. So the frailest among us from a physical point of view can move mountains with the aid of machinery and computers and so on. Whenever one sees an analysis of the Social Security system, you always see retired people up here and little genderless people down here and talk about how many of them are vis-a-vis how many are going to be retired. But what we don't change is that those numbers ever growing smaller to support those who are up here, you shouldn't just have this human figure, but you should have them sitting at a computer or something else, because the ability of this single person to have outputs from the same amount of inputs is substantially higher than it was, which is all good news, except it creates a great deal of superfluous labor. And in some ways, that's part of why we have early retirement. And golden parachutes is precisely because people become superannuated. They are not needed at a much earlier point. Now, a third phenomenon that's more cultural than it is in terms of hard data, but just as real, and it's affecting people, and that is a shift from communitarianism to a high degree of individuality. That we have great emphasis at this particular moment upon entrepreneurship, individuality, personal initiative, and a whole variety of other things, and some loss of the sense of responsibility for others. And so how do we square these things? More dependent people, fewer people really needed in the economy to produce stuff, and a certain loss of the sense of community. These things all come into play and, of course, have an enormous impact upon all of us who are older. And we're seeing the fruits of that at the present time. Now, switching gears into the immediate political considerations. And it's ironic, interesting, but it may well be that the next presidential election and certainly congressional election may be a plebiscite on the role of government like we've not had in recent years. Although it will be interesting to see how the issues are framed and how the choices are offered to us, because it gets kind of fuzzy, a lot of social issues and a variety of other things that may not be as clearly drawn as could be. But it's very likely that we are not going to have a budget before the next presidential election. We may continue with a series of continuing resolutions that basically leave things in place to the degree in which they can be. I do work with the Council of Policy Advisors to the government, governors. And it's kind of interesting because the governors are down saying, give us block grants, and we'll figure out how to do it, do away with federal regulations. And the policy advisors I'm dealing with are saying, these people have to be out of their minds, because we really do not have the equipment back in River City, call it Albany or Harrisburg or whatever it is, A, to have less money, and B, to figure out how are we going to change the current structures of government, particularly when it comes to frail and vulnerable people. So it's going to be kind of interesting to see what we have. Now, again, without being partisan, this is merely sort of the facts. During the Reagan administration, there was a commitment to reengineering government. And Mr. Stockman has made it very explicit that without being overly clear of what it was going to mean in the short haul, the tax cuts, just Laffer curve notwithstanding, really were not designed to increase the revenues of government, but rather to dismantle the welfare state. And indeed, that's where we are at the moment. starting with President Johnson and the difficult decisions about the Vietnam War and the problems of having guns and butter, the Great Society, and the Vietnam War, we began to run an enormous federal deficit whose continuation was absolutely assured by the Reagan tax cuts. So this has posed enormous difficulties to the point where we have come today of saying, left-right administration, Congress, and saying the deficit cannot continue, that in some period of time we are going to have to reduce it to a zero sum, whatever the cost is. Part of it's pragmatic, part of it's ideological, but the reality is there and will create the condition in which we're going to have to make very many, very painful choices. The magnitude of these choices has not really been felt yet because of this deferral through the continuing resolution process. And that continuing resolution process, by and large, has continued at the state level as well. But whether we're talking about Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, or the Older Americans Act, all of which profoundly influence older persons, they are all on the table and will all have to be dealt with. And many of the things that we have taken for granted heretofore will not remain the same in the future as they are today. In some ways, there really is no choice once the fundamental choice has been made about the balancing of the budget. Let me speak for a moment about Social Security. And I've mentioned to some others in the course of informal conversation today, were I the president elect, in the first 5 minutes of my administration, I would appoint a high-profile, blue-ribbon, bipartisan administration congressional task force and lock them up and not let them eat or go to the bathroom until they made a number of decisions about Social Security and that everybody agreed upon them and that we agreed as the administration and hopefully Congress would agree whatever this group came out with that we would accept. This would not be unprecedented because we did it in 1982 where we made a number of decisions in regard to Social Security and indeed they were sound decisions. Now, without getting too technical, and there are probably some people here know more about than I do, but there are two fundamental problems with Social Security and why we have to deal with it better sooner than later. Although it is fundamentally sound, and without any hesitation, I say it's such a building block in the whole social fabric of the country that it is vital that we restore confidence in it and that it be maintained in a sound fashion, which it can be. The first difficulty in Social Security is the way in which the funds are being utilized. During the Vietnam War, we made a decision to consolidate the federal budget. And so Social Security was brought into the overall federal budget. And Social Security then and continues to run substantial surpluses, which in effect disguise the depth of deficit spending in our country. The second thing is that Social Security, in terms of the excess funds that are being collected, are being used to buy treasury bonds. You know, if you have a deficit, somebody's got to pay for it. And while the Dutch and the English and the Japanese buy lots of American bonds because of the fundamental economic and political and social stability in the United States, who knows whether it's going to last forever. But a large part of the deficit is basically financed by Social Security that purchases treasury bonds. Now, the first problem with that is those treasury bonds have to be redeemed in the future. So even though theoretically, up until the year 2020, there is continuing surplus in the system, that, as they begin to pay it off, they're going to have to redeem those bonds, which means a rollover, a rollover, a rollover, interest on interest on interest. That is one problem. And the other problem is just the change of the population of the baby boomers going through. As we noted earlier, there are three elements in demography. One is fertility, the second is immigration, and the third is mortality. And nobody is absolutely sure in the future of how those three things will pay off. But at least in some looking at the future, it could well be there will be out of balance in terms of the number of people contributing to the system if the baby boomers have low fertility, of how will the system be continued. So I just note that that is the first thing that can be fixed by, there could be a whole series of different options, and those options will soon be brought before us, at least three basic approaches, because there is a Commission on Social Security now functioning whose report is due out in the next week or so, which will pose a series of different options. There is consensus in the committee that needs to be fixed, but how you would fix it, it depends on a series of where you invest the money, what do you do about taxation, and do you invest it in the stock market? Things of that sort. What do you do about raising the age of Social Security, and what do you do about taxing Social Security benefits? There are ways in which you could raise taxes in a modest way, or some combination of all these is what undoubtedly will come out with. Medicare is another issue and a very difficult one for us, because in the Medicare scheme, we are in a position of immediate inflows and outflows occurring at the same time. Again, there are different philosophies about Social Security and social insurance generally, not to put you all asleep about it, but there were those thoughts, should you fund it like you would fund a private insurance program, that is, build up such a enormous amount of monies that actually the interest would pay for things, or do you do it on a pay-as-you-go system? By and large, the decision has been made, public policy, we cannot fund these programs because it would take so much of the capital of the United States to fund them, and it would put it in the hands of government that it would put too much power in one place. What was decided upon, it would make sense if in terms of the three other trust funds beyond Social Security that we have under the FICA tax, if basically we put enough away for 1 year's benefits. Given that the inflow and the outflow, if you had 1 year in trust, then that would give Congress an opportunity to change things over a period of time if they had to be, trim the benefit or increase. Well, what has happened in Medicare is that the expenses have continued to climb and Congress has not fixed the benefit, have not changed it. Two basic elements are involved in the Medicare problem. One has been the number of people using it, and the other, really three, the number of people using it, secondly, the amount of services that are used, and three, the cost of the services that are there. Medical inflation outstripping ordinary inflation by 100%. So without meaningful reform in health care, it's been very hard to contain the cost. So something will have to be done in regard to the Medicare system in relatively short order. And, of course, that's one of the great debates between the Congress and the President, the administration, of how that ought to be handled. Perhaps the most difficult of all of the questions is the question of guarantees for the poor. And what do we do with people who are in need, people who are on SSI, Supplemental Security Income, which is a federal state program, and also in Medicaid. In Medicaid has been growing at a rapid pace. Once again, the same factors are at work, medical inflation, the growing number of people on Medicaid, the aging of the population. How are we going to cut the costs? The budget resolution that was passed by the House and the Senate would slow the increase of Medicaid to about 4 to 5% a year, where the increase had been about 9% a year. So it would about halve that. One state that I am most familiar with is New York. That would mean a cut of $22 billion over the next 7 years under the Medicaid program. A billion here, a billion there, that's a lot of money of how you would absorb that. The President, the administration's consideration in this regard would be about half that. Still an enormous, cutting it down to about a 7% increase over this period of time instead of the 9 that would be expected. The other kind of phenomenon that is at work is that not just a cut in the number of dollars, but it's a change between the relationship of the federal, the state government, and the basic role of government. In the last, since the New Deal, the general philosophy has been the federal government would have a role to assure the poorest of the poor would have decency. In many ways, the change in Medicaid and in supplemental security income would mean the federal government would abandon this role and leave it to the states. Many of you are familiar with the change that's taking place in the private sector, and that is from defined benefits to defined contributions. At Fordham University, 30 years ago, somebody went to work there, they would have in their contract that they would be afforded a pension of X number of dollars per month, commencing at Y period for X years. And they would have health insurance of a certain amount. Well, at Fordham University, as in many other places, that's no longer done. What is done is that X percentage of my salary is taken out for retirement purposes. I may choose to supplement it if I wish. Its actual management of this amount of money is left up to me, to a large extent, as to where it will be invested. So what comes out at the end, if I retire next year or 5 years from now, is largely a function of how well wise I have been in where that money is invested and in what the stock market has done. And pretty well of late, I don't know what it did today, but it's been doing pretty well of late, and that I would do this. I could put my money in bonds and be very conservative, or I could put it in emerging markets in Japan or Europe or someplace that might be much more iffy, and if my bet is right, I would do much better. That's one thing to do it in the private sector. It's quite interesting. That's what the federal government is going to do now, both in Medicare and also in Medicaid. In effect, it's defining the contribution that the federal government will make to the states, beyond which it will not go. Again, the Medicare proposal is monies would go if indeed the expenditure was higher than what was budgeted, then in the following year, providers and consumers would have to make up the difference. Greater coinsurance and deductibles, or charging less, or whatever the case may be. In the instance of Medicaid, the states would have to deal with a lump sum of money, and they will have to make decisions about eligibility levels, reimbursement to providers of care, things of that sort. So it's quite a change of the from defining the benefit and government being the safety net to defining the contribution and leaving that up to whatever each of the individual states in order to decide what they would do. Now, the states, in turn, are not sure what they should do. There are certain eligibility levels that are there that are mandated through Medicaid. Every state has a different Medicaid program, but there are certain fundamentals they all have to observe. State wideness, that there's the same benefit whether you're in Harrisburg or Philadelphia, that providers have to be reimbursed reasonably, a variety of things. But all of that is out the window, including it could well be the standards in nursing homes could be greatly relaxed from a federal point of view and be left to the states, which may be fine, but could be very difficult. Of course, what the states are doing is the magic of managed care. Now, managed care, how many of you are in managed care programs? I'm curious. Put your hands up high so everybody can see. Just, well, you know, a minority of people are there. By and large, managed care has not been a very predominant structure in the East and particularly the Northeast, where in California, if we were to ask this, probably 80% of the people would put their hands up. What managed care in effect says that I, as an individual, or the seminary as an employer, or Pennsylvania state government, will buy insurance on behalf of the people for whom they bear responsibility, and they will give a lump sum to this, $4,000, $5,000, to a managed care entity. That entity will be required to provide certain benefits. But how they provide them, under what circumstances, in what place, is up to the managed care entity. They, in turn, will provide the care to people on the basis of what they think is best in terms of economy, prevention, and a variety of other things. Now, managed care is not new in this country. The Kaiser Permanente program in California, Puget Sound, a variety of them have been very successful, and people are basically satisfied with them. It's been economic, it's had preventive care, it's had continuity of care. But a number of them have been somewhat dubious in the way in which they provide care. It's one thing if I choose it. In the state of which I'm from, in New York, it's required that I, as an employee, is given a choice between managed care and fee-for-service, point of service, and various other things. But when, if you're on Medicaid, the states see this as a way of managing their expenditures and are very likely to go into managed care, both for acute care under Medicaid and for long-term care, nursing home care as well, which will change the power relationships substantially and the vulnerability of the user substantially. The desirability for the employer point of view of defining the benefit, of course, is they know what they're going to expend every year. There's no guesswork in a managed contribution program, I should say. In a guaranteed benefit program, they have to change every year because you don't know what it's going to cost. So we're in a whole shift of the relationship of government at the federal level, the state government, to those who are dependent upon it for need, and we will have less money to spend, so we will be reforming, particularly changing all of the systems for dependent people. Developmentally disabled, mentally impaired, frail, elderly, people who are substance abusers, and the problems of those suffering from AIDS and other diseases. And that's the kind of difficult decision you folks are going to have to deal with in Pennsylvania as we are in every other state. A cruel dynamic that will be unleashed by this will be competition among the states. It's already been there, but as long as there was a certain federal base for Medicaid and Supplemental Security Income, then there was a certain equality among the states. Now the notion of a national entitlement is gone. So there will be a tendency, largely fueled by industry, that's looking for low taxes, and communities that will try to attract business in to offer them incentives with reduction of taxes. And, of course, Pennsylvania will compete with New York. Pennsylvania will compete with West Virginia, and it will go all the way down the line. And we've seen what's happened in the past. The looms of Mohawk, where I'm from in upstate New York, are now the looms of North Carolina. The recent GM strike was precisely about outsourcing breaks from the Great Rust Belt down to North Carolina, who, by the way, through their incentives, have brought BMW and Mercedes-Benz to make their cars because it's cheaper than doing it in Germany because they have fewer social welfare benefits. So we're going to find ourselves in a very fascinating, excruciating process of new decision-making throughout the whole United States. Let me stop back for a moment, and then we'll open this up before I bore you all to tears about these various things. I want to talk about what really is underneath all of this from an economic point of view. There's a new book that I would recommend to your consideration. Some of you may have read it, although I've seen some people who have panned it. But nonetheless, it's very interesting to give consideration to. It's Lester Thoreau, called The Future of Capitalism. And his basic thesis is, he has two things he talks about. He said, well, in evolutionary processes, there can be certain periods in which modest evolutionary process, something comes from outside, a catalytic agent, and all of a sudden you have a revolution. The other uses the metaphor of the plates of the earth, the tectonic plates. And he said there are five tectonic plates in terms of the world's economy that are in motion, and earthquakes can occur. The five are the fall of communism, which he points to having two sides to it. One is most communist economies have been internal, have not been involved with exports, and what we have with the fall of communism, a relatively well-educated workforce that now becomes part of the global economy. And he used the example of the auto industry in Germany, in which you have the enormous inequality between East Germany and West Germany, and how they put that into one economy. And the German worker who's making a car in West Germany getting $28 an hour, and in Poland getting $4.50 an hour, even though they have similar educational backgrounds. So that's one facet of it, of these various communist economies now being part of the global economy. The other part is that so much of our energy and activity as nations has been over and against communism. And that has been the enemy, and so much of public policy, international policy, and so on. And now there's nothing to be over and against. So it's capitalism all by itself. The second thing he mentioned is the question of the change of population. And he recognizes that we've got to face it. There are three different elements of population, just the growth of it in general, the growth of the dependent population that I spoke of earlier, and also the question of migration. There is enormous pull in terms of the northern hemisphere, where there is relatively high development and a push from the poorer countries to move upward. And that's what's happening in our country as we see immigration to a large extent from South America, Mexico, Caribbean, of people who, answering the siren call of the American economy coming here. It's the same great concern in Western Europe. They used to say that the Volkswagen is the best Turkish-made car in the world as people are coming up there. And again, Islam, particularly coming into Western Europe, the concern not just about population, but the concern about the historic culture of the land and what influence it will have. The third element that he mentions is the question of the change in the whole production of things to an intellectually based kind of commercial enterprise that is not dependent upon proximity to raw materials. Again, the great steel industry grew up in Pittsburgh as a result of the ability of the rivers, the coal mines, etc. But with easy transportation and so on, that doesn't prevail anymore. So one of the great exporters of products based upon steel would be Japan, that has no natural resources at all. And the ability of Mercedes-Benz to say, if it costs too much in Germany, we'll go to Poland or we'll go to North Carolina. So the increasing mobility, the way things are produced. The next element, the fourth element, is the question of a global economy, where indeed as new kinds of NAFTA, the whole different ways of which we're doing things, it isn't based in one country. And he points to the notion that the United States, it's hard for us to realize it, but at the end of World War II, virtually every other economy in the world had expended itself upon war. And in some ways, we were not only spared war, but our economy grew at an enormous pace and was singular in the whole world. And again, we had the good judgment, moral sense, and good practical judgment to rebuild our enemies, the Marshall Plan and our friends alike. Because most economists would say you can have no insular economy within a country that is not ultimately based upon the whole world's economy. You know, we are social justice people, but even if you weren't interested in that, you can't beggar your neighbor. And if there are enormous disparities, inevitably there'll be social unrest. And in some ways, the only way now the American economy can grow is if the economy of Mexico, the economy of South America grows at the same time, so that they are both producers and consumer of goods. And the last area that he points to is the question of no longer do we have the single place where capital is developed and exchanged in Wall Street, but rather it's in Singapore and Tokyo and London as well, and there isn't any central force at work. Now, the last point he makes, and it goes back to the earlier points I've talked about, is a reflection on capitalism. Capitalism and liberalism, traditional liberalism, are very close to one another. Of course, the notion of, you know, the hidden hand of Adam Smith, that if you just let people pursue their own self-interest, that everything will work out well. Herbert Spencer in 1866, you know, said really it was the duty of capitalism for the common good was to drive out non-producers, and he was the father of the eugenics movement to get rid of those who were, quote, inferior, which later gave rise to Darwinism in some ways and even gave the notion of natural selection and things of that sort. Capitalism is amoral, and I want to be very careful how I say that. I'm not saying it's bad, but it doesn't bring with it its own morality. All it brings with it is the notion to maximize profits. And indeed, that really is what's happened in our nation at this moment, that any compelling social vision and now it's given way to the economic metaphor. And Thurlow mentioned this as well. So healthcare, that's been so close to my heart for 35 years, and I'm deeply involved in, of all ages, is now that there's the commodification of healthcare. We don't talk of it as ministry anymore. We talk about the efficient production of services. We see reductionism, and it becomes a very technical kind of a thing that has little to do with caring. And so what we need to do is to develop some sort of a compelling social vision that serves as a brake on unbridled capitalism, which is absolutely counter to what we're doing in state and federal government with managed care and competition. Again, I made the confession this morning, I make it again this evening. I was one of those non-paid, full-time, non-reimbursed White House employees during the early stages of the current administration that put together the Clinton health care plan. And, of course, among the great fears is it would be socialization, and it would take away choice, and it would be competition. Well, now we have the worst of all worlds, because we have the socialization taking place at an incredible pace in healthcare. You know, the majority of physicians are now salaried employees of somebody. That we have these massive systems that are building up. Some of the Franciscan Health System and the Daughters of Charity, where for every one of those, there is an investor-owned HMO that are becoming colossus. The socialization that is taking place is all within the marketplace and outside of government. It is a fascinating thing. And by the same token, the competition that is there will not be a managed competition that was proposed in the Clinton plan. That is, people would have to have an even playing field. They would all have to pick up the poor, and that would be put into all of the plans. Now we have the way to be competitive is to exclude the poor, to exclude the high risk, to exclude those, really is to insure those who don't need insurance. And of course, we now have not 37 million people without insurance, we now have 41 million. And when you ask people who don't have insurance, they say it's the old and the poor. It may be inadequate, but they got it. It's us. It's our brothers, our sisters, our children, who don't have insurance or who are underinsured. So this is, I'll finish with this thought. In some ways, this is where the moral force of the church has to come into play, and synagogue as well. Rooted in theology, I think most of us have a notion of the mystical body of Christ, the solidarity of people, that we are responsible for one's neighbor, that we live in community. You know, I could say here, I am lionized and honored, and I have a chair, and I'm a Monsignor, and all this stuff because I am good and made all the right choices. You got to be kidding. I made some good choices. But I'm here because of good mother and dad. I'm here because of grandparents who came to the Philadelphia area from Ireland, both to escape persecution, but particularly poverty, and wished their children to have something better. You can use the same words from your own circumstances. I'm here because of good schools, public schools, Catholic schools. I'm here because of people who fought in World War II and who preserved our freedom, if you will. I'm also here because of community knowledge. I would be dead were it not for the discoveries in medicine. And is it because of Dr. X is knowledgeable and skillful? Well, partially. But it's because as a community, we have invested in research. It's because as a community, we've paid taxes for medical education. People don't realize it. It's because we support the VA system. You know, the great Nobel Prize winners in medicine from the United States, they keep, you think they're from Bellevue or NYU or Cornell or Sinai. Most all of them are in the VA system that we support. We have made enormous community investments. This place is a symbol of it, you know, that have been made by our great-grandparents who thought faith was important and invested in these institutions. Well, I think somehow the church has to be a clarion call to communitarianism. Not just a communitarianism that is contemporaneous, but is over history and recognizes that we are the rich beneficiaries intellectually, morally, economically, in every respect, and that we enjoy the good life because of others. And there is thereby the obligation upon us to be able to contribute to the future as well. And in all economic decisions, there are sacrifices to be made. There are choices to be made. We can't have everything. All needs and desires cannot be met. But that's part of the asceticism, that's part of our religious tradition. Yet somehow the American tradition is tendency to say we want it all. We can't have it all. We have to make choices. And hopefully they will be walk, but also in walking the walk, in the way in which we organize ourselves as congregations, as parishes, as synagogues, in which we say, look, we all want development, but there's a price to be paid for development, in opportunity costs, in service costs, in economic costs, and we have to be prepared to share our time, effort, talent, and money with others. Others that we see, others we don't see, others that are here in our own country, and people in other lands as well. And that's it. I know that was a pretty heavy message at 7:30 at night, but I'd be glad to respond if there's any challenges or insights, and I'd like to learn if others have different perspectives on things. I think the most dramatic, the poor can be quite invisible to a large extent. But I'll tell you where it's going to hit within a year or two will be in all the areas in which we provide services to frail people, developmentally disabled, mentally impaired, and in nursing home care, things of that sort. Because all of these are based in the Medicaid system. And I think that the federal reduction in contributions to the state of Pennsylvania and every other state will be so dramatic, virtually every state will be a dramatic loser in that. So this will bring about a conversation at the local level in which things we've taken for granted heretofore will have to be reexamined, which I think will bring about then not only the decision-making, but the questions underneath it. How do we decide who's eligible? What are family responsibilities? Should we impoverish spouses with their husbands going into a nursing home or for home care? These will be the tough decisions that we'll have to make. Should we medicalize everything that has to do with the developmentally disabled? With the passage of Medicaid, state governments, by and large, Medicaidized many of the services, human services, because that's where the money was. And so, various kinds of housing for the mentally impaired and things of that sort that were paid for by local funds, we brought into the Medicaid system, and it cost twice as much to do the same stuff for them. Now the question will be, should we demedicalize and socialize these kinds of things? This will be true in the field of aging, of how do we use nursing homes in a more discreet manner. We tend to split hospital care, state mental health care, developmentally disabled. We do them vertically, yet they're all related horizontally. And somehow, how do we rearrange the system so there's true complementarity and continuity? And how are we better stewards of our resources? So that will be a matter of great debate, because when it comes to, for example, nursing home care and Medicaid, to many people, that's a middle-class benefit. It isn't just the poor and the black. Somebody says there's two kinds of Medicaid. There's black Medicaid and white Medicaid. Black Medicaid tends to be for women and children. White Medicaid is nursing home care. But as that's cut back, then all of us will have to face it where we deal with it. My mother and dad were paying about $10,000 a month when my father died just in September for nursing home care. $8,000 for my father in a nursing home, $2,000 for my mother in assisted living. That wasn't going to last very long. But I know for every person like them, there was another couple who probably had more money, that somehow had used good legal advice and who had sheltered their resources for their children, which is another thing we have to face. I knew how to do it, but I wouldn't do it because I think it's wrong. But that will be an interesting issue for us. Oh, yes, absolutely, yeah. Well, I think that in some ways, if you take the United Kingdom, where there is a cultural notion that older persons will not use certain kinds of medical resources. That's pretty common. It's not written in the law, but having, I think, gone through World War II, suffered and rebuilt the country, to a large extent there's a general acceptance that where there is a shortage of organs for transplant, for example, that really that ought to go to persons who have family responsibilities and we will not seek them. And so that's a very much of a voluntary acceptance, I think, not moneyed economy, but it's an economic decision in terms of what resource is available to us. In the moral tradition of which I'm part and generally agree with in this area, the notion of economy, that is burden upon family or burden upon the broader economy, is certainly a legitimate consideration in the decision of whether to seek medical treatment or not, which is different if I choose it than if we require people not to have it from economic choice, though indeed we do that, which isn't really rationing, it's just as an authoritarian way of saying this person gets it by reason of class and this person doesn't get it. Real rationing occurs, by the way, just from a definitional point of view, when you withhold something from somebody who could buy it. We have rationing, we had it in World War II. I remember the A sticker and the sugar coupons and all that. And indeed, there always is a black market whenever you have rationing. But it's a question, the stuff is there, and if you just let capitalism go, some people would buy it, the rest of the people wouldn't have it. That's the same in organ transplants and so on. That's real rationing, as opposed to allocation that may take place by reason do you have money or not. And do we give money to people so they can purchase what they would not otherwise be able to purchase? And certainly we have to make societal allocational decisions in the future. Yes, please, way in the back.